Welcome to Season 8 of EdTech Insiders, where we speak to educators, founders, investors, thought leaders, and the industry experts who are shaping the global education technology industry. Every week, we bring you the Week in EdTech, important updates from the EdTech field, including news about core technologies and issues we know will influence the sector, like artificial intelligence, extended reality, education politics, and more. We also conduct in-depth interviews with a wide variety of EdTech thought leaders and bring you insights and conversations from EdTech conferences all around the world. Remember to subscribe, follow, and tell your EdTech friends about the podcast and to check out the EdTech Insiders Substack newsletter. Thanks for being part of the EdTech Insiders community. Enjoy the show. Today on EdTech Insiders, we're talking to Kunal Dalal and Wes Kriesel, who are administrators of AI and innovation at the Orange County, California Department of Education, where they support AI education and integration for 28 school districts in Southern California. Kunal Dalal merges education and AI, driving human-centered AI integration at the Orange County Department of Education. Educated at Oberlin, Harvard, and UC Berkeley, he's evolved from school principal to headphone entrepreneur to tech educator. Dalal's entrepreneurial and community efforts, alongside his AI-focused initiatives like the AI Parent Book, AI Days, and the upcoming AI Summit, showcase his dedication to enriching education with AI, advocating for an empowered, collaborative learning community. Wes Kriesel is an administrator of AI and innovation at Orange County Department of Education. In his work at OCDE, Wes built orangejuice.ai, where he shares stories from around Orange County about AI in education. In addition, Wes is the producer for Squeeze the Day, that's D.AI, the orangejuice.ai podcast that covers AI in public education. Three guiding values for Wes's work are inclusiveness, storytelling, and innovation. Wes enjoys photography, his dogs, his Jeep, and spending time with his wife, in reverse order of importance. Kunal Dalal and Wes Kriesel, welcome to EdTech Insiders.
Hello, good to be here.
Likewise, happy to be here.
Yeah. You say good to have you because you guys are podcasters too, and I know exactly what that's like. It is good to have you both here. So let's start off by each of you. I'm going to go one by one. Tell us about your background and what brings you to this really unique and very interesting role of being an AI administrator at the Orange County, California Department of Education. Kunal, let me start with you. You've done a lot of things. School principal, teacher, you are an entrepreneur with a headphone company. Tell us about your background and how it brought you to your current role integrating AI in education.
Thank you for that very copious introduction. That was very kind of you. Our titles are exactly how you said it. You got it right this time, Alex. Nice. But we are administrators of artificial intelligence at Orange County Department of Education. We're in 28 districts throughout Orange County. And to answer your question about my journey, what brought me to this space right now, I started way back when as a wilderness guide for students who were coming out of juvenile lockup. And that was, you know, I had this job where I was cutting up rats every day doing science research, and it was starting to feel a little bit heavy for me. And then I called a friend of mine and I was like, you know, this is really hard. The science work, I really like it, but is there something else for me in this world? And my friend on the phone, he's like, you know, I'm doing this wilderness camp thing where we have students who are sentenced, it really was that word, sentenced to 2 months in wilderness camp. Maybe you'd want to come out here and try this. And so I packed up my stuff and moved out to Utah. And then, you know, it didn't take me but a few weeks to realize this is it. This is what I want to do. I want to be around young folks. I want to be in education. When I was in high school, I used to say, I'm going to become a teacher when I can afford it. It's not a not a great view on that profession as far as payroll goes. But that took me into education. And then I became a teacher. I was a teacher in Boston and then in Berkeley and Oakland. And then I went into administration, high school principal, assistant principal. And then I was an entrepreneur for a little while, as one does when you live in the Bay Area. You got to get that CEO founder on your business card at some point and on your LinkedIn. And so I started a headphone company and back and forth to China, the headphones that are on my head right now. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done. It's some people, I mean, outside of my kids, let's not downplay raising kids. But I do use an analogy there because a lot of folks talk about how, you know, having a pet, having a dog, and this is no slight to anybody listening here who's got pets or dogs, but when you're raising, I've raised a dog, I've raised a pair of headphones, and raising a pair of headphones felt a lot closer to raising a baby than a dog did. And the company dies if I'm not on it all the time. And if I'm not aware all the time, a dog will survive. A dog can go, like, you can give a dog to somebody else. You can, you know, you can rehome a dog. You can't do that with your own business. And so when I saw my first set of headphones at the factory table when I was in China and I went into their little room, it was a lot closer to when I saw my first baby than when I saw my first dog. I know that sounds absurd, but I think for a lot of folks who have built a physical product, my guess is you might feel something similar. But you know what that really did? I went into tech after that. I was in some Silicon Valley companies and I was the education person, really. I'll talk about probably in some response later in the podcast. But what that journey has taught me is less about tech, because I was always the tech person. I was the first person to have a projector in the front of the room when I was a teacher back in 2002. But what it really taught me was about entrepreneurship. And it really taught me that this idea of building something and creating something for yourself that is out in the world for everyone to judge. And you have to own it for yourself. You grow with it. You evolve with it. But it's yours. And you get to see something that never existed in the world now exists in the world. And you did that. That to me is what I learned through my journey as far as what the most powerful thing to do in education is. And so really that's when I talk to students, when I talk to kids, tech is there, AI is there, everything else is there. But the idea of creative entrepreneurship, I think that's the most central thing that I sort of hold on to.
Hmm. Yeah. And you're both in this incredibly unusual role. And I think that diverse set of experiences probably brings a very diverse perspective. You've seen the tech side you've seen technology side, you've seen the education side close up, and now you're working in this incredibly integrated way. Wes, tell us about your background and what brought you into AI and public education. You also do a podcast. You produce the Squeeze the D AI. Am I saying that right? Squeeze the D AI?
We always say Squeeze the Day, D.AI.
Got it. Squeeze the Day, D.AI. There is no AI. Squeeze the Day podcast. Tell us about what, your experiences and what brought you to your current role.
Yeah, just starting with the podcast and working kind of backwards. Around 2010, I worked for a virtual school, and I really learned a lot about being able to serve students when you couldn't see them. What kind of things could you produce that would be helpful? Video. That's when I started video editing, podcast editing. But really, the last 28 years have been in public education. Although I kind of wonder if there's some relevance to, like, right out of college, I didn't know what I was going to do, and I served as a youth pastor for a couple of years. And I often think about that kind of nurturing the whole person, looking after their soul, if you believe in that. I think that's still part of how I look at education. And so I think since then, I've realized that most people, especially in an ed tech space or an AI space, if you will, they don't feel like they know what other people are doing. They're interested in finding out new ways to connect to students and improve learning, but they maybe don't know. Their struggles are very similar to someone else's, or their questions, even though they might approach the answer differently, are similar to other people's questions. So I think storytelling ends up being a big part of what we could offer in a leadership role. And then that's also just part of recognizing that my one voice, my one perspective is not the sole value that I offer, much like yourself. Telling stories, giving other people a place to talk and share is huge.
It really is. And I think, you know, I'm hearing creative entrepreneurship, storytelling, sort of humility, I think intellectual humility, and realizing that this world, especially this AI and education world, is evolving so fast. It's so complex. No one person has the answer. If we bring everybody together, maybe we begin to have an answer. So let's talk about some of the initiatives. You mentioned, you know, you're at the Orange County, California, 20 plus districts. I think you said 26. Is that right?
28
districts. So let's talk about some of the things that you've been initiating and working on in this role. Kunal, let me start with you. You have this 100 conversations in 100 days about AI initiative. You guys are both planning a student-led AI summit. There's all sorts of things. Kunal, let me start with you. Tell us about some of the projects that you've started in this role and how they are contributing to a more informed and empowered community of educators in the AI space.
Yeah, I mean, so I'll let Wes talk about 100 conversations. That was actually his entry plan for his work. Honestly, it just speaks to Wes and his absolute focus on the community. He came in and he said, "Hey, I'm going to have 100 conversations in 100 days about AI. I have nothing to suggest to anybody. I'm not trying to sell anybody anything. I'm not trying to train anybody. I just want to listen." I'll let him talk more about that. But I'll talk about the AI summit that we're having, which is April 25th, which is a week from today. And whew. I know, Wes. And
yeah, we should start planning that.
Yeah. But, you know, we've been to multiple AI summits, and they're coming thick and fast these days. But one of the things that we did with one of the summits we went to, this was the AI K-12 Deeper Learning Summit in Anaheim, is we brought students. We brought about a dozen students to the conference. And during some of the keynotes, you know, they were talking, and then they were talking, and then they were pontificating, and then talking again. But the students were sitting there thinking, they're talking all about students, and we're right here. Like, but no one's like, we're sitting right here. Like, you can just ask us instead of being like, hey, but I think students this, but students are best this. We're right here. And so that really sparked it. There was no beginning. It just sparked, and then it happened. This idea of, hey, why don't we have a student-led version of this? Because the students we had are part of this organization. I'll use that term loosely. And it's a group of students in Orange County that are doing AI work already. So they're building apps, they're building websites, they're doing all kinds of really, really interesting things, storytelling, all kinds of stuff. And so these students already have stories to tell. They already have experience using AI. And so we said, hey, why don't we do a summit that's for students by students? So students are doing the keynotes. We have these three incredible young women who are going to be doing the keynote. Students are going to be leading all the breakout sessions. They're being co-facilitated by sometimes industry partners, sometimes their teachers, sometimes some other mentor. And we have 14 breakout sessions. We've got keynote. We've got a little student panel. And then we have, I think it's up to 30. Don't quote me on that, but it's something, I guess you're going to have to quote me on that since I'm on here. But I think we have almost 30 vendors who are actually going to be in an exhibitor space. So they're going to be able to walk through and get their little baggies and their little swag and talk to sales reps and all that. Just like anybody would do, any of us adults would do at a conference, like we just did over at ASU GSV. And so that's the idea. And I think the students are really excited. We are excited and very nervous because this hasn't been done before, and it came together really, really quickly. We'll be at the JW Marriott at Anaheim. So yeah, we're pretty excited about it.
And will people be able to access it either during or after the conference if they're listening to this and they aren't able to be at the hotel itself? Is there going to be access to it?
Yeah, so we're going to be live streaming a bunch of the breakout sessions. And so you can join right in, or you can watch a recording afterwards.
I mean, I really admire, one of the first things I think we connected on when we all first met is that what you just said, Kunal, about they're all of the, this is a community, right? The AI and education community is wide ranging. And one voice we have heard surprisingly little of in this conversation, I think people are starting to recognize this, is actual students who are in many ways the ones using technology, innovating with the technology, also in the hot seat around making sure that, you know, school policy affects them positively and it doesn't get them in trouble and all sorts of things. And there's so many reasons why students' voices should be centralized in this world. but I don't think it's happened that much. There was a AI conference last year run by some college students, also out of California, and that was another really interesting initiative. But I have seen very little of high school, of K-12 students really leading AI work. So I'm incredibly thrilled. I can't wait to be at this conference myself. I won't be there physically, but I will be on the live stream every moment. Wes, I want to use that as a segue to your 100 Conversations project, because I think that's a similar thinking there. It's, you know, how do you get as many voices, as many opinions and perspectives in the room at the same time, or at least asynchronously, so that we can truly understand the effect this technology is having on everybody? Tell us about that project and what you learned.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about 100 Conversations is it's one-on-one, or like when Kunal's there, it's maybe three of us. And the amount of information you can get from somebody and the amount of space you can allow them to wander and kind of explore their own thinking is very, very different than any type of group setting. So if you want to do a teacher training, go for it. But I've been in professional development for 20 years, and I'll say that the effects are limited when you have an intention and a group of 20 or 30 people. Oh, shoot, we're just actually talking about education in general. The effects are going to be limited from one person to a group. So my goal is to understand what people were thinking. So I really wanted to do these one-on-ones. And then shortly into that, probably 20, 25 conversations in, we start asking people like, but what about your students? What about your students? What about your students? And we actually met a student named Kieran at Estancia High School at Costa Mesa, who he said, ChatGPT changed my life. And we're like, okay, say more. And he said, I started in January 2023 asking it if he could write me stories about anime, kind of these worlds I was interested in. And then he sort of evolved into a creative director saying, write me stories. He was spending hours a day. And Kunal asked him, like, was there a moment you knew that you were different? And he said, it was the day my English teacher gave me a final. It was handwritten, 5-paragraph essay. I felt zero imagination, zero ability to handle tasks like that in writing. And he's like, I just flew across the paper, a pen on the paper, and I wrote 7 paragraphs, not 5. I was done in 10 minutes. And that moment, I think he said, rewired his brain. And I think Kunal said, maybe you rewired your confidence. You know, it's an interesting debate. But he said, my vocab increased because I have more words, like ChatGPT loves words. And so I'm immersed in that. But for example, Kieran's story then propelled us to go, well, if you can do that, why can't we ask other students to jump in and start using ChatGPT as a reading tutor? So we actually have an AI reading pilot going on around the county, working with small groups of like 5th graders here, middle schoolers here, 9th graders here, just on the premise that if you tell ChatGPT what you're interested in, you give it your reading level, and then you just immerse yourself in those stories that are of your design, you have agency and you have kind of buy-in to that reading. So that's been an incredible outcome. And then the other one really has been classified staff, or in some other places, it's maybe called office professionals, admin assistants. So I've been doing job shadowing and trying to understand what their roles are. And this, I would give a shout out to La Habra City School District. The superintendent invited Kunal and I into a future leaders meeting, talking to like groundskeepers, classified staff about AI. And from there, we realized we didn't understand their roles completely. So we did job shadowing. I would have them ask them to send me their share links from their chat so I could see kind of a cognitive task analysis, how they're using it. And so we do, from that has developed, we do a weekly Zoom call called Office Space. Shout out to the movie of that title. And so we have 60 or so secretaries, admin assistants who are on the list. Not all show up every week, but it's a space where we're having this countywide conversation about how to, whatever they're struggling with across the county. I guarantee you, if you're in an office struggling with something, somebody across the way has the same problem and maybe a better workflow. So just trying to connect people who are trying to solve problems. And really, it doesn't sound like I'm talking about AI a lot. It sounds like I'm just talking about kind of design thinking or, you know, problem solving, some sort of human engineering. And maybe that's true. And we'll see where it goes. But AI has been helpful for a lot of these people just finding out what it can do for them.
But I think that open space, a couple of points really, really, really jump out to me in what you're saying. One is that idea of having one-on-one conversations and really going deep with people has a very, very different effect than a big high-level group conversation or, you know, Kanalia said earlier, you know, people pontificating around students or around educators or around staff without actually bringing them into the conversation. So I think people really, really talking deeply about this very strange moment is incredibly important and sharing their perspectives. And then I literally get goosebumps when I hear about this student who starts with an interest and says, I like anime, tell me more about anime. I love anime too, by the way. You know, I like anime, like tell me more about the, let's do some fan fiction. Let's build some worlds. And then it completely changes their self-perception, their academic self-efficacy, their ability to confidently tackle an academic task, like a 5-paragraph essay. Like that's the dream, right? That's the dream of what AI can do for our students and our world, right? Is meet people where they are, what they're interested in, and then get them to be able to empower themselves and get skills and get communication abilities and make something of it. It's like, it's just so, such an exciting, and that you can only get a story like that by having those one-on-one conversations and really going deep. It's really powerful. So where can people access some of these? People who are not in the county, in the OC, are any of these published everywhere? We talked about the summit, but your 100 Conversations initiative, like, are you planning on putting that out in the world?
Yeah. So, Alex, we have a website, orangejuice.ai. So some of the stories are there. The link to the podcast is there. Originally, the goal was to take all the transcripts, because everything's audio recorded, take the transcripts and then use an LLM to kind of look for trends. And that is still the goal. However, the trends were pretty obvious, is that people in kind of middle management positions were not acting. They were kind of listening and waiting. And so that was kind of the big trend. So we started an EdTech Leaders Network. That was one of the outcomes, is that we have a monthly meeting of all the EdTech directors, coordinators, TOSAs, just to hear each other and kind of do problems of practice. So check the website.
And that's Orange Juice, like orangejuice.ai. That's
simple as that.
And that's the name of the summit as well, right? The Orange Juice AI Summit.
So the summit is called the Student AI Convening. That's what we're calling it. But it's on Orange Juice website. It's one of the tabs over there. Yep.
Gotcha. Yeah. And as always, we will put links to all of, you know, we put these links in the show notes for this episode. Hopefully we'll do our best to get this episode out before the summit so people can hear this and go to it. We're going to scramble to do that. But if we don't, you can still go there and see the recordings and see some of these initiatives, because it's really, really, really exciting. Kunal, I want to double click on one aspect of this that I think some of our listeners might be interested in, which is, you mentioned early on, I think you are two of the only people in the entire country who have a sort of AI specific role in education system. I think in the future there will be many such roles, but there are not that many so far. I'm curious about where you think the world is going and how listeners to this podcast might go about sort of accelerating that in their own context. And if they're an educator trying to focus on AI, if they're an administrator trying to move into a role like yours, if they're a tech person, you know, how can they help school districts begin to embrace AI the way that Orange County already has?
Yeah. I mean, what an immense question with no real answer, right? but like, I think we're starting to kind of prototype answers at this point, right? Like, and I think, you know, first off, the role, yes, it is a unique role. We have not found anybody who is yet in the space. I 100% expect that. I hope that will change over the summer. I expect it to. And so what this role has offered is for all the school districts who are in Orange County, EdTech leaders, teachers, and all that, it's a visual sign. The county office, which is often seen as kind of a backwater, you know, it's the same probably across the country. Oh, you're at the county office. I mean, that's where careers go to sit in their grave. And so to see the county office have a position like this that is unique to the country, I think elevates AI, but also elevates the entire idea what innovation might look like coming from a county office, and therefore what it might look like at a district level, and therefore what it might look like at a site level. And so there's this symbolism of it, but also there's this, Wes and I have a certain freedom being at the county office that a lot of folks who would be embedded in a district do not have. In California, my guess is this is similar in many states, the counties don't make policy for districts. Districts have their own school board, they've got their own superintendents, they've got their own parent bodies, they make their own rules. And then we as a county office come in and support where we can. And so that gives Wes and I a fair bit of freedom to not feel like we have to set up a bunch of rules, we have to set up a bunch of policies. We can actually come into places and inform almost in a consulting role, but then also when needed, go in as one-on-one trainers or group trainers and all of that. And so it's offered this real wraparound kind of space. And also, I was talking to a couple people in the hallway there at ASU, and they said, oh, your job title sounds so cool. So what is it you do? And, you know, we do so many things, but it can sometimes feel a little incoherent because AI is incoherent right now, right? And so it can sometimes feel like that. But then I saw one of our ed tech directors walking down the hallway, and I was like, Giordo, come here. Can you tell these people what I do? Because I'm having a hard time figuring out how to describe that, how to encapsulate that. And so he said, and it was very uplifting to hear how he described it. He said, what Wes and I do is we build out and support networks of folks who are actually in sites and in district offices and in classrooms. We make the space for them to all come together. We help lead discussions or just give space for them to lead discussions. Again, we have more time to actually keep up with AI, for lack of a better way to say it, than folks who are in the district. And so we can bring things to them. We can tell them our insights and all that, but it's up to them. So we create space for that network. And then the thing that I think really affected me is he said, and you too bring the human element every time. You bring the humanity of teaching back into these meetings and back into the AI conversation all the time. And I think that's something that Wes and I pride ourselves on, is centering the human. AI is just a giant mirror on our humanity, right? And we are learning more about what it means to be human through AI than I think we have in a lot of things. And so that's a lens that, again, we have the freedom to explore. And so that's what we get to do.
You can hear it in the way both of you talk about your initiatives, is that, you know, it's student-centered, it's educator-centered, it's staff-centered, and the idea of making space for the conversations, I think, is so important right now, and something that is not often, you know, mandated or supported. And that's why, I mean, to your point before, Wes, about why people feel siloed, and they're like, I'm not sure exactly what to make of this. Is it just me that doesn't know what to make of this? Or does everybody not know? And if the space isn't made to have that vulnerability, everybody stays siloed and does it at their own pace, which is wildly different, or ignores it or is afraid of it. And so I think that description is really valuable. And I think that concept is really valuable right now. Let's talk about this sort of bringing the conversation together piece, because it is something that is clearly a through line of your work, the humanity and the space for conversation. I feel like I'm trying to do that as well in my own way, right? Bring together all these different perspectives. If you could say three things, I'm going to go for three, and we'll go back and forth here, both of you. Three things that you feel like have surprised you about this work since you started the role. What were you expecting that didn't come to light, or the opposite? What sort of popped up and made you feel like, oh, okay, there's a real there. We did not see that coming. I'm curious what your reaction is to a question like that.
I think it was the first week I started the job, we went out to lunch and somebody asked, what are three pillars or three words that guide you? And I was like, storytelling, inclusion, and innovation. And so when we started the podcast, quickly I realized I wanted not just me, not just Kunal, but I wanted other voices and not just guests. One of the things I found out by interviewing CTOs is they felt like there was just a lack of voices around AI, including like no CTO-focused AI podcast. So we recruited two IT staff from local districts and worked out an MOU so that they could come and host. Every other episode is Jeremy and Alex, And not only are they like, we're more ed tech, we're more educational administrators. Not only are they like site techs and network analysts. So you have that. Jeremy's Mexican American. Alex is African American. I'm white. Kunal's Indian American. So, and then our student interns, Mark is Black. Finn is Polish American. His first language is Polish. In our conversations, I have been blown away about my need not to say anything. Like when I just hear them go at it, I'm like, this is the best. And because you have this kind of rich mix, and then it's, we have 16-year-olds. Alex is, I'm going to say mid-20s, not going to out her exact age. Jeremy's in his 30s, Kunal 40s, I'm in my 50s. Like you have this crazy cross intergenerational where it's interesting what the students will say. And we always joke, Kunal and I, we call ourselves the analog elders. Like we really came from a land where there was no digital. And so this cross-generational approach is we need to replicate that in more spaces. And usually we have sort of kind of a siloed generational thing happening. And again, that's another way of saying the importance of student voices, but it's also classified. It's also people in different sectors within the education system. So most amazing thing has been letting a rich mix exist. Mm-hmm. And there's probably a bad pun, but it's like fertilizer, you know, just to get in the rich earth and let things grow organically.
One of the things that surprised me, and it's sort of dawned on me more in the last month, 2 months or so, is how critical families and parents are to this process. And I know that sounds, that to me, when I say that out loud, it sounds obvious that I should have been thinking this all along. When we talk about school, when we talk about education, we never downplay the importance of the community and of family and of organizations like that. But I published this little almost pamphlet type thing last year called the AI Parent, just talking about how AI was helping me in parenting. And it was just like a super basic thing. Oh, I'm using ChatGPT here. I'm making some images with my kid, that kind of stuff. But more recently with this debate about AI in schools, it's really dawned on me. And I know Wes is, it's like Wes is, and I are going to be leading some parent stuff here in Orange County soon. But it's really dawned on us that if we can actually, rather than stressing so hard about AI being this, got to get it right in schools, we got to get it right in schools, we have to get it right in schools, what if we step back and actually said, wait, what can we do to actually build AI empowerment, AI fluency in homes, in communities? And if parents are using AI, if families are using AI, you know, just things like, hey, let's do a weekly meal plan on Sunday and let's sit down on Sunday. Everybody take a picture of what's in the pantry, what's in the fridge, go on to AI and go create a weekly meal plan. Let's sit down around a dinner table on Sunday and let's work out a meal plan. Or like some of these kind of counseling conversations that we talk about, emotional support, a lot of opportunities there for family, just like family growth, right? Ways to talk to one another. And then, you know, I wonder if families start to talk about AI and use it as a partner in family life, then that might actually depressurize this whole conversation around AI in schools, because we know AI is happening at home and we know we're not taking away AI from students. And of course, we'd have to work out how we're going to build out resources so everyone, you know, can equitably get this. But that actually seems less of a lift for me when I think about it than it does to figure out how to recreate this entire behemoth structure of education around AI and having to be so focused on making sure that schools are the place where these young folks are being educated in AI. So that's something that was surprising to me. I mean, I knew that it was relevant, but I didn't, especially with how heated this debate is and how long it's been dragging out, it really is more and more clear to me that actually let's go a little bit even more fundamental than that.
When I hear you talk about the role of families and home, you know, home access in this, it brings me back to the early days of internet, when online learning or search or, you know, just the ability to, is like, feels like ancient times, but like, you know, the ability to use the internet for education was just starting to take off. And I think that didn't start in schools. it didn't. It started at home. It started with access to, at least among many people, it started with access to the internet at home. Then it started going into schools in a very, you know, structured and safe way. I don't know if, I'm sure the two of you remember the WebQuest days of education. And then what happened, as to your point, Kunal, is we created a little bit of a quote-unquote digital divide. Then there was a lot of work to do broadband initiatives and make sure people could actually get it at home and all of that stuff. So I guess my question coming out of that is, if we are at this sort of tipping point, this pressurized, as you said, it is pressurized, it needs depressurization. If we're at this sort of pressurized moment where we're, this is what I feel at ASU, and this is what I feel talking to a lot of AI innovators, it's this pressurized moment where I think there's a time period where education and edtech field can sort of convince the world that AI's positive externalities outweigh its negative externalities, that it's worth it. And I think one of the things that is so interesting about all of your work is that you're working with students, you're working with educators, you're working with school staff, you're working with district administrators, you're creating space for those conversations, you're working with parents, as you just said. And my take has been that if enough people really love and are excited by AI, that when bad things start to happen and the schools start to say, you know what, maybe we shouldn't be doing this here, there's enough positive will and enough positive use cases and people are excited enough about it to say, even though these things are possible, let's still work it out rather than throwing out the baby with the bathwater. It's a sort of an alternative scenario to what you just posited, Kunal. I'm curious what the two of you think about that. Like, do you think that there is going to be a sort of backlash moment and the type of work that you're doing is going to help smooth the path to not, you know, really putting the brakes on AI in school hard? Wes, let me start with you with that one.
Sure. There's been a couple of headlines recently following some AI nude image generations. And I have a Google alert for Orange County and AI. So I see these and the headlines are really, really misleading. And so they're saying things like schools are not prepared, when in fact, schools have been dealing with students doing inappropriate things with technology since it came out. A colleague of mine says, you know, students, when we gave them pencils, they drew naked pictures of their classmates. And so do we ban the pencils? So there's this already the interest in the public eye is to go, oh no, what's going wrong? Because that's, you want to know that so you can protect your loved ones and protect your community. And I don't have a perfect answer. I do think though, there is a spirit of playfulness that I think AI allows us to get into where you can actually use it for some interesting initial experiences. The things that Kunal talks about in his AI parent book, story generation, image generation, even talking about doing that with your family members is something that we've really not done in EdTech trainings. We're always talking about you need to get Google certified or Apple certified, and it's how well you know the tool. And in these cases, we're actually talking about relationships. And so that's a playful space. It's a trusting space. And so the more we can talk about how AI can improve our relationships, that's one way to sort of ground the conversation in humanity, if you will. You know, I just saw on social media, another shout out to La Habra City School District, which is actually where I am right now. The superintendent was doing some sort of like, you know, if the kids raised enough funds for, you know, charity, he would do a slime dump over his head. And so, you know, he's there on the field and all the kids are cheering and he's having the slime dumped on him. And so in that case, like that's a good analogy of how I see is like, we have to get dirty. We have to be a little bit foolish. We have to be a little bit clownish because we're leading others by our example. And if we're all like doom and gloom, I don't think that's an accurate picture of how to live life. And so the scary thing is we don't really know what the future is going to be, but that's always been the case. And so you basically choose the character you want to play in this moment. And so I think being playful, being joyful, using humor, and just being experimental and trying to bring people into that space is going to win more people over but it's a vulnerable position, obviously.
And I think to add on to that, we talk about there's so many different ways that we want to talk about AI in education, good, bad, negative. Oh, focus on this, focus on that. Oh, we can't do this until we have an ethics document or a policy document. And if you're not doing it that way, then you're doing it wrong and you're making things unsafe. And there's so many different takes and so many different ways in which folks who are leading this work or even adjacent to this work are thinking. And often I see a sense of, I see this antagonistic look at someone who's not doing it exactly the way you're doing it, who doesn't have the exact lens that you have. And in fact, I think that in a moment like this, where we're talking about education, right? We're talking about the biggest thing for all of us. Human learning is probably the most central thing to being a human. Our brains are so big that we can't hold them up when we're born. Like, our brains are so big that our skull has to collapse on itself to get out the birth canal. That's how big our brains are. And so thinking and learning is our thing. That is our thing. And so in this space where we're redefining learning, redefining the most fundamental thing about us, I think it's actually, rather than sit here and decide, you know, what the right way to do it or wrong way to do it is, I actually think it's really important for all of us to appreciate that we all inhabit different spaces in building out this organism, that some of us have a different perspective. We might say, hey, focus on this, focus on that. I might say something completely different, but we're still parts of the same organism. We still have something to learn from another. And some of those might live in tension with one another, but I think that's a good tension. Like, at this point, with something this big, we have to have productive tension, because if we don't, then likely it's going to look like it's looked in the past, where power interests are going to just like roll over the less privileged and the less resourced. But in order for that to not happen, we have got to stop trying to like say other people are doing it wrong. Oh, bad, 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 bad. No, 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 hold on. We don't know anything about this. We know nothing about this. This is the first time we're redoing education since like the 1800s. So let's listen to everyone, and we're all part of the same organism.
It's a really interesting comment. Yeah, I'm part of the same organism. I feel like that a lot these days in ed tech.
That's what you do, Alex. That's what you do. You bring the organism, the organism together. So I appreciate that.
Exactly. And it's like, you know, you have all these different, especially right now, you have literally hundreds of ed tech and AI companies and startups. And then you have all the edtech incumbents, the Canvases and the Pearsons and the Kahoots and Quizlets, you know, that are incorporating AI, Duolingo, you know, Gen AI and other kinds of AI tutors, like as fast as possible. It's like the entire edtech ecosystem is sort of like a macrophage, like embracing AI, trying to get its head around it. And I'm really excited about this as a moment. I'm personally also nervous about the sort of dichotomous media narrative. Like, I think you both sort of mentioned that we know that there's a million perspectives, that there's a million different options of what AI in the classroom even means. And it's been in the classroom for years in Google, you know, suite. But because it's so new, I think there's this sort of feeling of like, you know, AI was out when it started in schools. They were like, it's a cheating tool. It's out. We ban it. Then a few months later, oh, it's in, it's the future, we're into it. Mm-hmm. And now I think, you know, the needle sort of swinging somewhere in the middle. And I look at it and I'm like, I just really want us as an industry, both the techies and the founders and the administrators and the superintendents and the educators, to find a way to at least keep it on the positive side of the ledger, because man, things are going to come. And I mean, I think your point, Wes, about the pencils, you know, you give somebody a pencil, they're going to draw naked pictures. And certainly when the internet went into schools, that was a primary concern for all the right reasons. It's like, it's really about narrative to me. It's not about the actual truth. I mean, the truth is this stuff is here for good, and it's going to be used in a gazillion different ways. But the narrative, I feel like we have to own. I'm curious how the two of you think about your role in helping shape the national narrative, not just within Orange County, the national narrative of AI and education, especially with the kind of work you're doing with like the Student Summit and your other publications. I want to ask both of you this, but Wes, let me start with you.
Yeah, I think it goes back to inclusion, working with classified staff, office admin, working with students, trying to make sure we're looking at the diversity of voices from a race and ethnicity perspective, talking about using these tools in our different jobs. We have to be stocked up on stories from multiple perspectives. I can't go in and say, well, in this one district, we did this one thing. Like, I have to be ready to go. And that means I have to be with people sitting side by side. Like right now, I'm with a fifth grade class and they're part of our AI summit, but they're presenting on VR, Oculus Quest. And I'm talking with English learners about how do you see this impacting your learning? And they're going to be in front of 7th through 12th graders. And why? Well, it's a 7th through 12th grade conference on AI. Well, these students, this is where they're entering. And this is where they're going to be part of the conversation. And we've used ChatGPT in every session I've had with them to help get ideas, to help do warm-up questions. And I'm making AI a part of their experience, even though they're kind of onboarding, they're on an on-ramp into this larger conversation, but they're going to be informing us. And I want that conversation to start early. I think one of the takeaways from Ethan Mollick's book was kind of invite AI to everything. That was a good tip. And one of, I would say, the promising practices here is when a district says we're going to put it on every leadership agenda, we will play with the tool. We will talk about it every time we meet. That's smart. And I think that's part of us continuing to be responsible for this, the way the narrative shapes. You can't go to sleep on this for a day.
No, you can't. Not even for like an afternoon, it feels like, at this point. But like, that's right. When we're thinking about the narrative, it obviously, like, second everything Wes just said. And then I'd add that there's like this, I feel like there's competing narratives, right? And this is part of our society, right? Like, we have a capitalist society where sort of the ideas and everything are in a marketplace, and they can feel competitive. And certainly in the AI education space, LinkedIn has been one of those like competitive town squares almost of like whose ideas are going to get out. And at the same time, when you read everybody's ideas, you get this incredible, I think, this really wide, vast swath of what is happening. You see what teachers are talking about. You see what administrators are talking about. You see what edtech leaders are talking about. Old school ML machine learning, like computer scientists that have been doing this for 30 years. Like, there's so many incredible perspectives. And for me, that is the narrative. The narrative is that this has involved us so deeply that we are all talking. You can't walk down the street and there won't be people talking about AI, right? Which I thought was going to be the case last summer because I was so obsessed with it. But, but you know, now certainly it's the case. Like, last year when I was telling my mom that I'm publishing this AI parent book, she was like, "What? What are you even talking about?" And now she's like, "I think you did a good job. Good job getting in on that." We had NBC come into Wes and I's office to just do a little piece on the work that we're doing. And when they came in, they did the story, cool. And afterwards, I was at home with my son, and they told us when it was going to come on. So I turned the TV on, and there's Wes and I on the news. And, you know, my boy, he's 4 years old. He did not care about Wes and I on TV. The only thing he said was, "Uncle Wes is way taller than you." And I was like, yes, he is. And it's also the angle of the camera. I'm not totally short, but yes. But what he did say is the second they said AI, he just snatched his head toward me and he was like, "Bobby, we do AI. I do AI. I'm good at AI." And I was like, you are really good at AI because of all the little things that we do here and there with him, all the little things that he actually kind of shares with me. Because sometimes he's like, "Hey, can we get on? And like, I just thought of something." And so that, to me, when I saw him, I look at him and I think his head is not first going to go to the negative uses of AI. His mind is likely not going to go to a place where he's like, "Ooh, I'm going to bully somebody with this. Ooh, I'm going to find some way to get over on somebody with this." He is thinking of it as this joyful, as Wes says, playful space. And if that can be the narrative, that this is a joyful, playful space with the recognition that, boy, do we got to think about safety because this thing can get out of hand really quickly. And we got to think about all those other pieces. But lead with joy, and then I think joy will follow. I don't know.
Yeah, I love that. I hear you both saying playful, integrated into our lives, you know, invited to everything, part of our daily existence, and relevant to a wide swath of stakeholders. It's not English language learners, school staff, you mentioned groundskeepers. Like, I really think that you're onto something very, very core there. And what's great about it is it wouldn't have been my answer. I think you're onto something that I would never have come up with on my own, which is the way to make AI feel acceptable and inclusive and exciting and not, you know, more good than bad, to use my metaphor earlier, mm-hmm. is to make it feel joyful and make it feel like everybody's there and everybody's getting something out of it and it's fun. My favorite thing I think I saw at all of ASU at the air show, this use case that one of the vendors had made with a teacher, where they basically created an escape room from inside the human body, where you're starting in the body and you have to find your way out of the body through some natural orifice. And of course, it's, you know, interactive, it's choose your own adventure, and everything is generated in real time. And I was like, that is playful.
That's
like
fun.
That to me, that's like the definition of a playful use of AI. So yeah, I get it. And I feel like you're shifting my thinking as well. Let's talk about, you know, I know that AI is on your minds all the time, but let's get nuanced here. We always end our interviews with two questions. And the first is, what is the most exciting trend, and specifically kind of coming trend, something that people might not already have their eye on? What's the most exciting coming trend that you see in the edtech landscape right now? But I'm going to challenge you both to, you know, obviously you're not just going to say AI. What is something that you sort of spotted and you're like, oh, nobody's talking about that yet? Even the Twitterati, even the LinkedIn, you know, everybody talking on LinkedIn. Like, what's something that you think from your particular perspectives, you're like, ooh, that's something that I've heard very little about, but I think it's growing. Either of you could start there. I know that's it's a tall order question.
So one of the things that I have been thinking about is creating immersive environments with text to 3D or text to 360. So we just invested in some Apple Vision Pro. Obviously, I'm working with a student group here with VR at La Habra. But the idea that when you see Sora and you go, okay, I can go text to video, like I know text to immersive environment that I can access through a 3D headset is here, it's imminent. And having, it's kind of like we say, like your coding schools, your coding academies need to completely stop and have a, you know, a moment of silence for coding, because you really are now talking to the computer in natural language. And so your students can, your third graders can say, make me an app that does this using Python. And it's a different game. So I'm thinking our students, as they're developing language, they are generating immersive environments that they can put each other in. But it's a collaborative space. That's the one thing
that's
is
cool.
I think people always think the metaverse is individual and you're isolated and you're disappearing into your own individuality. And I say, nobody really, really wants that. People want to be socializing. And so creating immersive environments with each other, for each other.
That is so cool. I imagine a classroom where, you know, 12 different students are studying different countries. And what they do as the project is each one of them takes the rest into the country. They're like, okay, we're going to go to Russia. We're going to go to South Africa. Let's go look at Brazil. And they guide them through. I mean, wow. Now we're talking like real sci-fi. That's exciting stuff. I love that.
Yeah.
No, how about you?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'll give you one exciting thing and one concerning thing, I think. And exciting, well, there's probably a lot of both of those. But I think one exciting thing that I think a lot of folks who are steeped in AI are talking about, but I barely saw any of at Airshow or ASUGSV, is agents. And AI agents, they already exist, but in the probably near term, we're looking at potentially public access to AI models being able to create fairly sophisticated agents. I mean, Devin already exists, but that's like a very case-built specific agent. But I'm talking about like in your own LLM experience, your chatbot is able to sort of self-propagate agents and be able to build out a robust kind of research and get job done structure that will make kind of this single line of chat LLM look a little bit, you know, babies in diapers. And so So that's something that it's exciting, right? Because it's what are the possibilities there? They just took the possibilities that we have right now, and now you've magnified it by however many orders of magnitude. And so students will be able to get things done, get advice, be able to actually have the AI agents debate one another and be able to learn things that they'll never be able to learn otherwise. So I'm excited by that. But on the flip side, I don't think that we as educators talk enough about what that means for the workplace and what that means for this future that we're preparing our students for. We are still talking about standards that were developed a century ago. But we are also talking about a workplace where when AI agents become ubiquitous and likely first going to go to the people who have the most, you know, obviously have the most funds and are able to actually pay for how much it's going to cost to make these agents go, what does that mean for our students? What does that mean for what we're teaching them? And I was a little bit disappointed at ASU-GSV that I wasn't in any session where that sort of larger, and it is almost an existential question. And I think that's appropriate. Our system built on capitalist productivity is going to be completely upended by artificial intelligence agents. And as we continue this process of our students learning, are we asking learning for what? Are we asking that question enough? And I don't know that we are.
Yeah. I don't know what Devin is. Can you tell me what that is?
Oh, yeah. Devin. So end-to-end software agent where you just text in, hey, I need a YouTube video done about this, or it's actually software, so it's coding. So it's more like, I need a script written for this to create this workflow. You can give Devin a listing from like Upwork or any one of those sort of like contract sites, and it will literally read the description on Upwork and go through the entire process and have the product done at the end. And you didn't have to talk to it at all. You can talk to it. And what's another amazing thing about Devin is it gives you status updates. So it'll tell you, oh yeah, I'm working on this, I'm working on that. And so it's impressive. It's, again, it's only for one thing. It's just for writing software right now, which is no small thing. But this is going to be, this is going to exist in fintech. This is going to exist in banking. This is going to exist in medical. I mean, it's going to be everywhere. And so what are we doing?
Fantastic point. And you're right, I didn't see much about that at ASU or AirShow too. John Bailey, who's sort of an EdTech veteran, put out a deck recently. And one thing jumped out to me from it that reminds me of what you're saying, which he said that, you know, the Google paradigm, right? The internet search paradigm is, why do you go to Google? Google acts like a librarian, basically, right? You tell it what you're interested in and it finds resources for you. And, you know, that was miraculous, you know, unbelievably miraculous. But to your point, AI is not a search engine. I mean, it can be used as a search engine, but you can create personas and roles for almost anything. You know, coders, project managers, teachers, tutors, you know, anything. You could create a team around you, be like, you know, I want to do this project. I'm going to play this role. And here I'm going to make three other roles that'll do this as a team for me. And it seems like so relevant to everything you're saying about, you know, the future of the workforce, because that's what the workforce will probably be like too. And the power of AI that I don't think we've even really begun to get our heads around, or I'll say that for myself. I haven't begun to get my head around it because it is really exciting. It's like if Google's a librarian, these LLMs are everybody else, yeah. Anybody.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We call it the messy mindset. Yeah. When we teach it, Wes and I, we say Google mindset versus the messy mindset. Google mindset, we've been 20 years indoctrinated into this space where shortest number of keywords, pithy, like figure out how to get all that. And of course, you're also infused with the worry of too much SEO and you're not going to get authentic results. Whereas generative is generative, right? So like be a little messy. It's actually generative AI works really well if you don't fully know what you're looking for.
My big epiphany moment with LLMs was when I started researching what people were calling like the perfect prompt. And the perfect prompt included telling the LLM to ask you as many questions as it needs so that it understands what you're actually looking for. And I realized that was the moment when this sort of messy mindset idea clicked in for me. I'm like, oh, right. You don't even need to know what you want to start talking to this thing. You can just start brainstorming. Hey, I'm thinking about this. And it's like, oh, interesting. What about
that?
It's crazy.
So a great parallel or touchstone to that is our student Kieran,
who said, I changed my life by learning to read and write better with ChatGPT. We had a follow-up lunch with him and we said, okay, we're going to do this reading pilot with other students, kind of break down how you get started. And he says, well, I always do character building. And I always say, ChatGPT, ask me 20 yes or no questions about this character that I'm about to start with. And we're like, shut the front door. Because what happens is I take my phone and I turn on voice chat mode. And when I'm with the pilot group of students, I say, here's what Kieran did. We're going to do it. And I pass my phone around and they answer the question about, is your character male or female? Does your character have a small family? Does your character have a pet? And you see all of them lean into the parts of the story that they're building. But I tell them, I said, you're putting the cognitive load on the chatbot because we're all going to create a story, but we don't have to be faced with this blank page anymore. And so you see the students just gravitate to that structure when you present it. And why yes, no questions? It's because we can do it quickly and build more efficiently. But they see quickly there's so many ways to work with this. And it's just, you know, like a genius like Kieran who just said, I'm gonna make it work for me.
Yeah. You turn around the relationship, you know, you say, this is what I want. Now you help me figure out how to make it happen rather than, you know, I have to figure out what I want and you're going to give me an answer. It's so different. I wish we had more time. This is so much fun. You should all come back and everybody should check out orangejuice.ai and the summit. Hopefully this is in the future as you're hearing this, but if not, it will surely be a consistent event. Last question. What is a resource you would recommend, you would each recommend for somebody who wants to dive deeper into the topics we discussed today? Kunal, let me start with you.
Our blog, I'll plug my blog again. We've got a lot of good stuff there, orangejuice.ai. But I think also, This is a massive question because there's so much stuff. How do you keep up with AI? Like what does that actually even mean? Because AI world is now moving at the speed of AI, not at human speed. And so there is no real meaningful way that anyone can really keep up. And so I actually shift the question around like resource as being a self resource. And I know that sounds corny, but I think that the people who are keeping up are the people who are keeping their own North Star aligned, keeping their own values intact, keeping their own who they believe is important and what they believe is important intact, and then going out and figuring, like, and then going out to, you can go to Ethan Mollick's blog, you can go to our website, you can go to Amanda Bickerstaff's Prompt Library. There's a lot of resources like that. But for me, the biggest resource is yourself. AI is a huge mirror, as we said. It is going to lead to literal existential questions about yourself. You've got to hold yourself tight. You got to give yourself a hug because that's what AI is doing for us.
I totally agree. Yeah. I mean, you got to know what you want. People ask me about graduate school. That's always my advice. Go in knowing what you want. Don't expect them to tell you what you want, what you're going to want to learn. Go in knowing what you want. If you stay true to what you care about, then they'll fill in the rest. But if you go in blank, it'll stay blank because they don't know what to do. How about you, Wes? Please.
Yeah. So I'm going to go with a book recommendation that is fiction. And it is Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro, and Anaheim Union High School superintendent recommended that to me. I listened to it on audio, and it deals with artificial friends and a family dynamic. And I just think it's a way to look at our own world without looking at our own world. So it's very helpful. I'm an English background, so you know I'm going to recommend a fiction book.
Fantastic recommendation. I love that. I love that author and that book as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very enlightening. My father loved it too. I got that recommendation to read that from my dad, and now we both love it. Fantastic. Thank you both so much, Kunal Dalal and Wes Kriesel. We really appreciated you being here with us today on EdTech Insiders.
Absolutely. It's been our pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of EdTech Insiders. If you like the podcast, remember to rate it and share it with others in the EdTech community. For those who want even more EdTech Insider, subscribe to the free EdTech Insiders newsletter on Substack.
This This season of EdTech Insiders is brought to you by Tuck Advisors. Tuck Advisors is a trusted name in education M&A, founded by serial entrepreneurs with over 25 years of experience starting, investing in, and selling companies. Tuck Advisors believes founders deserve M&A advisors who work as hard as they do.